My name's David. I'm an alcoholic. I'd like to welcome everybody to the Simple Actions Group of Alcoholics Anonymous. This is my home group, and I'm really grateful for everybody who came out tonight. Everyone who brought food, everyone who brought their good cheer. There's no one person that puts these things together. It takes a lot of people doing a little bit, and everybody just doing their part. There's something magic about when we all come together and break bread and just be together. And it's beautiful, and I'm glad you're all here. You're in for a treat tonight. I want to thank Steve and Billy for coming all the way from Madison. Can we give them a hand? For those who care to join us, let's have a moment of silence. Do it as you wish, followed by the Serenity Prayer. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Amen. Simple Actions Group wishes to extend a warm welcome to all in attendance this evening. These premises are non-smoking. Our group is welcome to use this room and the restrooms exclusively, which are across the main foyer and up a small flight of stairs. At this time, please silence your cell phone. Also, we respectfully ask that those present please refrain from unnecessary moving around the room. This will keep distractions and disturbances to a minimum and allow everyone to listen uninterrupted, unless you need a cookie or something. This group practices the spiritual foundations of anonymity, singleness of purpose, and effective sponsorship. As a group, we believe that Alcoholics Anonymous provides alcoholics with a set of clear directions on precisely how to recover from the illness of alcoholism on the basis of simple actions. These actions are contained in the book, Alcoholics Anonymous. It is the purpose of this meeting to carry that clear message and focus on precisely how to recover from the illness of alcoholism on the basis of AA's simple actions. The AA preamble states, Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution, does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. For those of you who are, maybe this is your first time here tonight, the normal format of this meeting, it's an open big book step study. Normally we have, and if you come back next week, we'll be on step one. We'll have a panel of two speakers. We'll share paragraphs from the big book, and then the speakers will share their experience, strength, and hope using those paragraphs as a point of departure. So we'd love to have you back. We're an open meeting. Everybody is welcome. And then after we do step one, we'll do step two, and so on. And then after we go through all 12 steps, then we have a lovely little event like this. And so I'm not going to take up any more of Billy's time. This is a man that I'm privileged to know. It's just been a wonderful experience getting to know him over the years. He's got a fantastic message, and we're all in for a treat tonight. Thank you, Billy, for coming out from Madison, and if you would, please share your story.
Hey everybody, I'm Billy. I'm an alcoholic. When I say that, I was down at a meeting down in Florida some years ago. I was traveling, went down to see my sister. I try to get down and see my sisters and my brother and kind of make some living amends. And I was at a meeting and I walked up to the door and I introduced myself as I'm Billy, I'm an alcoholic. And the guy looked at me and said, I already know 95% about you. Kind of set me back on my heels there a little bit, and he said, you already know 95% about me. And when we think about that, the fact that all of us drunks are here together tonight, we already know a whole lot about each other, even though we've never heard the details of the story or the individual personalities of everybody. We know what it's all about. I put a couple things down. I'll tell you in a minute about something happened to me. But anyway, my sobriety date is July 20th, 1998. My home group is Blue Ridge Speakers Group, which is a speaker meeting that meets at 6 o'clock on Sunday nights in Madison County. And if you're ever up that way, you're welcome. Love to have you come in. We have a guy 1 week and a gal the next. We've had a few people from down this way up there to speak. And when they get to come that distance, you know, they're the authority. You know what I mean? You're never authority in your own hometown. I mean, guys up here think, why would he send Billy all the way down there in Virginia Beach to speak? I mean, you know, Norfolk, but, you know, anyway. Makes it look impressive when you drive a long ways, but it's really not. I want to thank Steve for driving me down tonight. He's a good friend of mine, and he was very kind to take his car and drive me down and keep me company. And we talked and carried on all the way down and tried to keep the judgment machine off, and it was good. We had a good time. And I'd like to also, I want to thank David for having me down. This is not the first time he's tried to have me down here. I had a little incident last year and couldn't make it, and so this is my chance to come back, and I appreciate being given that opportunity. And I'd like to also say hello to all of you that I've never met before. There's some folks in here that I have met, that I've known for a long time and have deep respect for, and all of you sitting here that I have not met, you know, I hope we can become friends as well, because I don't know what meeting I'll be sitting in that somebody will share something that won't change everything about me for the moment, enough to keep me sober one more day. Last year, May a year ago, I stopped sleeping. I don't know what happened. I'd just come off of having two torn retinas, and I'd been in the hospital 25 times since 2000, and had been on the regimen for liver disease, and something just snapped. I don't know what happened. I've written a number of inventories on it, but I stopped sleeping May a year ago, and I didn't sleep again until December 10th when I was put in the hospital. By that time, I had completely lost my mind. I got 15 days in the hospital. I couldn't remember the past, the future, or anything. It was like I thought I'd died and gone to hell. I didn't know what had happened. And I couldn't read. I couldn't write. I'm a big book enthusiast. And I've been going to a big book study every week ever since I've been sober. And I couldn't read and make two words come together and make any sense. And weirdly, the only thing that I could remember was the 23rd Psalm. And that's the only thing I could repeat to myself over and over. 15 days later, I began to get a little memory back, and I was in pretty bad shape. And finally, they let me out of the hospital after 27 days, and I came home, and after a couple days, I got myself to an AA meeting. And somebody came down, I'm a welder, I'm an industrial welder by trade, and the guy came down, wanted me to repair something, and I went out to the shop and set the machine settings, and welded the piece I had to weld, and things just started coming back together. So I don't know, I'm probably 80-85%. I don't know, Donald was asking me about that earlier. I don't know where I am right now. I know that everything falls in and out. You know, I'll have something in my mind and it'll just be gone. But I think that happens to all of us, so not just me. So I don't want to be special on that deal. But anyway, that was the reason I didn't make it down here in October. I was in bad shape. But at any rate, we don't know what the bottom line on that was, if there were every kind of test they could think of, every MRI, every EKG and EEG and, you know, blood tests. And they found a couple of things they're not sure about. There's a theory, you know, that it might have been organic brain syndrome. They don't know. Anyway, it hasn't come back. You hearing me okay, David? I need to pick that up any? Come back at it? Is that better? Okay. All right. Well, anyway. All right, let's get down to business. I am a drunk. Thank God I'm a sober drunk today, and I will drink again. There's no doubt in my mind if I get separated from this any period of time. That was one of the things that happened to me last winter. I was very grateful that we don't keep alcohol in our home, and I'm not critical at all that those that do. I have good friends in AA that do, but I tell you, there were a few nights when the madness was on, not sleeping, that I think I would have done anything to just grab a few minutes sleep, and I was just really grateful that I wasn't in the room. Anyway, I grew up in a really good home. I mean, my parents were hardworking, moral, ethical, country folk. My mother was a school teacher. My father was in agriculture. I had three older sisters and an older brother. I'm the only alcoholic in that immediate generation. It is elsewhere in my family. But I was taught right from wrong. I was taught how to be where I say I was going to be and do what I say I was going to do when I was going to be there. And there was just a part of me that was broken from the get-go. I don't know what that was about me, but there was something about me ever since I was a little boy that was restless, irritable, and discontent. And I was a liar and a thief and a cheat. I mean, I was telling lies before I ever even knew about lying. It was just like I couldn't tell the straight story. And I would go steal little things like change off my father's dresser, and we lived 5 miles out in the country, and I have no idea where at 3 or 4 years old I was going to go to spend it. But anyway, I thought it was important that I have it. And, you know, I would learn later that I was not only a thief in that way, but I'd also be a thief of peace of mind and of hopes and dreams of my parents, because I was one of those people that was a knee-jerk reaction from a little kid on. I mean, if I felt it, thought it, it was real to me, whatever was going on in my mind, and that's exactly the way I acted, and I acted everything off of that reaction. I remember by the time I got to kindergarten, I could have stood a half pint. I heard that somebody say that one time. I thought that would have been just about right, because when I went to kindergarten, all these little kids are running around playing, and it's like, my Lord, you know, I just felt so different. I felt so cold. I felt so separate. I didn't feel like I was a part of anything. And those kids were playing together, and man, I just need something to knock the edge off, you know. And I wouldn't know that's what that was. I didn't know that was my alcoholism already coming into full bore, that self-centeredness, that part of me that somehow felt different, didn't feel enough, didn't feel like I could connect with anyone, but that was loud and strong. And I went to school. I was on the coattails of three sisters and a brother that were straight-A students. And they worked real hard in school, and they did well. But I was not a straight-A student. I will tell you, I am not a good student. I'm not a good test taker. I have to think about what I've got to do. I have to work about what I'm about to do. I have to study, which is something I never learned how to do. I'm not one of these people who started drinking at 16 and age 19 woke up with a PhD. You know, there are people in AA that that's happened to, but that didn't happen to me. I mean, school was hard going, and I was... You know, I did inventory, my first inventory, you know, some years later in sobriety, and I wrote on all the teachers. I must have had 80 teachers down. I mean, every teacher I ever had, you know, and the reality of that was I was the class clown. I was one sitting in the back making little noises, passing notes, trying to look up the girls' dresses, doing whatever. Anyway, I was the one that was being called up to the teacher's office, the principal's office, had my desk pulled up to the front of the room and set right by the teacher. You know, and it was me, it wasn't them. And that was just kind of the way I was. So everything was going along swimmingly, as you can understand, until hormones kicked in. And once hormones kicked in, a whole new world happened for me. And I just found I loved sick women. You know, AA's got some of those here too. I love the women in AA, but at any rate, you know, the rocks in their head fit the holes in mine. There was no doubt about that. And I started chasing little girls, and I started catching a few. And, you know, my whole idea of a relationship was if they looked at me and smiled at me, we were an item. And if we went out and I pat them on the head and their pants fell off, we were in love. You know, so. I don't know. I accumulated a certain amount of damage there and a lot of embarrassment from my family, and not pretty much for what I was doing, but just what I was trying to do, I think, you know. They had what I wanted, and I was going to any lengths to get it. And so at any rate, they sent me away to a private school, something they could ill afford. They sent me away to a school that was more than my father's salary for a year, hoping that somewhere, somehow, I would shape up and start to do the things that they were hoping that I would do. And man, I was really a duck out of water. I mean, there were a lot of nice guys there, and these kids were motivated. They came from good families. Some of them were there on scholarship, and some of them were there because they came from well-to-do families, and these kids had a lot going for them, and I felt really different. And one night, these guys are all out in the woods drinking. Now, I'd heard a lot of bad things about alcohol growing up. I had heard about, how it was really, you were just down and dirty if you drank, and you were disrespected, and how, you'd end up with a trench coat drinking under a bridge, and, it was all those kinds of things where I'd been told. And I remember going out in the woods with those guys one night, and I thought, well, I'm going to go to the bottom of the barrel and try this beer they're drinking. And I was about 16, 17 years old at that point, and I got about 2.5 strohs down. I thought it was nasty, and then all of a sudden something just clicked inside of me, and I came alive. It was the most magical feeling I'd ever had in my life. I call it a spiritual awakening. Something shifted inside of me. I had never felt so free, so at peace with the world, so at one with others as I had felt at that moment. At that moment, everybody loved me. The woods lit up in the middle of the night. It was just magic. And I didn't realize that. I think at that point I made some kind of unconscious decision that I would never be without that again. And I didn't realize the pledge that I had made and where that would take me, because drinking was fun. At those times it was fun. Just drinking everything I could drink and going to bed and laying there puking. I was kind of a nose puker or projectile puker, and stuff fountaining out of me at night in the bed. It didn't make any difference. I would somehow tough it through the next day and get back out there again. And, I got that farm boy work ethic, man. We don't quit, So I'd get out there and I'd keep going. And for me, that was fun. There were no consequences to that, even though gradually my grades deteriorated and they weren't doing real well as it was, but I managed to get out of that school and I went to college. I had been wrestling. I had done fairly well at that, and I had an opportunity to wrestle at State University, and I lasted about 1 month, and then that was over with because girls and booze took over again, and that was as far as that went. At the end of that first or the second year that I was at school, I was asked to leave college. My grade point average was less than my blood alcohol level. I tell that, tongue in cheek, but you understand it didn't take much for me to break that, because I didn't have very good grades. So, it was pretty easy for me to be ahead of that game. But at any rate, I came home like any good self-respecting son would do and came back to mom and dad and, decided to go to work with my dad in a little family business that he had and started working for him. And, I lived in a house with a couple of guys, and we didn't have any running water, and I'd have to go home in the morning, go by my mom's house, get on a coat and tie, go to work, be bouncing off the walls, just sick till about noon, get down to the local diner, have some hot dogs and beans, something with some sustenance, and get that down. I'd be telling myself, I'm not going to drink tonight. God, I was up all night long last night howling at the moon. I'm not going to do it tonight. All of a sudden, about 4 o'clock in the afternoon, I start feeling a whole lot better. The light bulb comes on. I think, I'm just going to need a couple on the way home, just kind of take the edge off. And somewhere 6 or 8 beers into it, or 6 or 8 drinks, or Wild Turkey 101, or whatever we were having, would take off, and it would be like, something's different about tonight. I don't know what it was about last night, but I got it tonight. We'd go through that all over again, come sliding in, knee-hugging, commode-hugging, drunk, and just sick, and make it back to work the next day somehow and bounce off the walls and somehow hang in until about noon and go back and get some hot dogs and beans, and it was kind of the way it went. And that would last, that would go on for me for a couple of years till finally I drank my way out of that business and drank my way out of that relationship. My father was kind and loving to me and never raised his voice with me, but it had to be entirely frustrating for him because I was not a producer. Because I was the kind of guy that I would go out, I was lying when I said wait till 4 o'clock. Quite often it would happen at noon and I would go home and then I would sit there and drink and think about all the things I'm going to do tomorrow, and tomorrow's going to be a better day. And he just finally just nosedived because I couldn't make it to work. And I got another job, promptly lost that job, and then I kind of couch surfed for about a year and a half and bummed around. finally, I decided I'd, when I was going through school and going through high school early, those summer jobs, I worked in a welding shop, welding mechanic shop, down in a series of quarries that were down the road from me, and I went down there and hooked on with those guys and being trained as a diesel mechanic, and I ended up liking welding because nobody else I knew was welding. All my friends are going to become carpenters and mechanics and everything else, and so that trade worked really well for me because I could come in dirty and tired and hungover and spit on my shirt, and it really didn't make much difference. Once I could strike an arc and get going, that's all they wanted to see. And, you know, and that worked for a while. And then somewhere along the line, it looks like I kind of pulled my pants up. I don't know what happened. I had a kind of a dark night of the soul. Thought maybe I needed to get my stuff together. I didn't realize that all those things that I hadn't done that I wished I'd done, and all those things that I had done that I, all the things that I did do that I shouldn't have done, and all the things that I didn't do that I should have done, and started weighing on me very hard. And I had a lot of guilt and a lot of shame and a lot of remorse. And I thought, if I'm just going to tough this thing up and we're going to make this thing go. And I'd been dating a girl who drank like I did. And we decided to get married. We were together about 5 years and then got married. And we were together about 5 years married. And we had a lot of fun. We really did. I mean, somehow my drinking shaped up. It looked a little more respectable. I was drinking with the country club people one night. The next man, I was with the bikers. It didn't make any difference, but I seemed to somehow get back on my feet every time. And this lasted for, like I say, almost 10 years. And then we started having children, and it looked like that was going to be a good thing. And then all of a sudden, things just started kind of going downhill. I don't know. I found that I couldn't drink. I had found sometime before that I couldn't drink in the mornings, because once I started drinking, I couldn't stop. I didn't know about the allergy of the body. I didn't know that I had this physical allergy that would start in me, that once I start drinking, I'm going to have little or no control of the amount I take. And once I stop, sooner or later, I'm going to drink again. I had no idea that that's what was going on inside of me. But so I would go for periods of time, you know, where I would not drink during the days. Some nights I wouldn't drink. I would just try to stay dry. Try to keep this job going, try to keep supporting these babies that were coming, try to keep my wife, you know, barefoot and pregnant, I guess. We had a... at some point, I would say this, you know, we talk about a little bit, and I'll just touch on this for a minute. I had been raised in a church, and I had been raised with right and wrong, but I had been also raised by my mother. My grandfather was a minister, and my brother ended up being a minister, and I'd been raised in church and a church life, but I had never gotten what we were talking about there, and I just kind of saw this God of my understanding as some dark, gray, severe spirit somewhere off in the nether regions. I didn't have a good relationship in that case. And I remember just kind of a little story that maybe kind of defines how I was feeling about God. We were living down on the Rappahannock River, and our drive was about a mile and a third long, and it was one Sunday afternoon. We were going to a wine, well, it was supposed to be a tasting, but it was a wine guzzling for me. And I got in a nice pair of clothes, held a pair of pants, nice pair of pants, and a sweater, and looked sharp, and got in the car. Of course, we've been getting ready since about 7 o'clock that morning, drinking moonshine whiskey and taking bong hits. But at any rate, we got out of that car and started heading up the drive, and I got up on this hill, and the car slid over in the ditch. It was raining. It was a dark gray wintry afternoon, and it was raining and old red Virginia mud, you know. And man, I jumped out the car and got my wife behind the steering wheel, and I got around the back end of that car, and I started trying to push up on that bumper, and she was revving, had her foot to the floor, and red mud was just shooting all up and down me, and I was screaming. And something happened. It kind of looked like it was like about a scene out of Caddyshack. All of a sudden, it looked like there was thunder and lightning, and I was screaming at God, telling him to go on, put it on me. I could take it, you know. And that was, and all that lightning and thunder and rain just seemed like it deluged all of a sudden. And it was this little feeling inside of me, maybe I shouldn't have said that. You know? And that was kind of relationship I had. It was a fearful relationship. It was not one of love. It was not one of forgiveness. It was not one of trust. It was not one of power. It was not one that would give me power that I would have soon that I would develop when I got here in a way that I'd never had before. We were down at that place for another few years, and it was our third child was born. He was kind of an odd percentage that child would be survive it. He had a diaphragmatic hernia in his intestines, and everything had gotten all mixed up, and he had a hole in his diaphragm, and his stomach was up in his lung cavity, and we didn't realize. My wife had gone in 2 months early with premature labor, and when he was born, he had like a 1 in 10 chance of living. They hadn't noticed it. They hadn't detected that. And he was at the University of Virginia, and they had a really, really, really good surgeon that happened to be a neonatal type surgeon who went to work on him and saved that kid's life. And anyway, that kid came home, and it was about a month after he was home. It was one morning I was going to work, and I had shoved a Pampers box full of trash in the old wood stove and kind of lit a little fire. It was one of those cool spring mornings, and just trying to warm the room up a little bit. And I went up the driveway. My wife walked up with me and carrying him. And I got up to the country store about 2 miles up the road, and a guy came running out and said, "Your house is on fire." And I drove back down there quick as I could and got down there, and my wife, as she had turned around as I was driving off, had seen smoke coming out from underneath the eaves, and she'd run in, and already fire had gone through the wall. Evidently there was a hole in the flue and the chimney, and it had a little bird had built a nest in there perhaps in the early spring. And anyway, that thing had caught the wall on fire, and it was right in the bedroom where the two kids were up there sleeping, the oldest two kids. And she ran in, and she was able to get them out of there. Fire was coming out the wall. The room was already full of smoke. And she got them out, and I got in there. And I tried to get stuff out the house. And the sad thing is, the only thing I could really think of to get out of the house was my cash box, my stash box, a half gallon of moonshine liquor, and my bong. That was all I could think of getting out of the house. I couldn't get out a baby bottle. I couldn't get out any diapers. I couldn't get anything up, pictures, nothing got out of there, but I just got the essentials as far as I was concerned. And I sat out there on the yard on a footstool and just kind of watched that house burn, and the fire department had gotten there, and it was a three-ring circus because they had a guy that didn't know how to work the truck, and, you know, it was kind of a country fire department. They had a time, but they finally got up there and got that thing out. But it was a burned-out rubble, and we were invited, obviously, to... Well, not obviously, but we were invited to my parents' house. They lived about 15 miles away, and her parents' house, they lived about 25 miles away. And we were invited to come there and stay, and I just couldn't do it. I needed to drink, and I needed to drink the way I knew how to drink. And there was no way I could drink and stay there under those, you know, if I went to their house, because there wasn't going to be alcohol, it wasn't going to be allowed at my parents' home. And so... We stayed there, and my wife would have to go over each morning and wipe the rubble off the stove. We had a little cabin out there in the yard that we stayed in, and she would go in, and she'd knock the rubble off and make breakfast, and that was kind of how the day would go on. I want to speed this thing up a little bit. We ended up moving from that place after some time, moved to a little house up in Madison County. It was a house, one of these fixer-uppers, you know. Got in there, and I thought maybe we were going to fix it up after we got in it, you know. And so that amounted to putting a little addition on and putting some insulation in there and running some drop cords and hanging some sheets over top the insulation. And had a sheet over the bathroom door where the doorway was. And we raised four kids. all of them through their teenage years, and they'd learned great respect for knocking on the door frame before they opened the sheet to go into the bathroom. You know, we're always going to do something tomorrow. Tomorrow we're going to come back, we're going to fix this house, and we're going to get it right, you know, and it just never seemed to happen. But about that, about the same time that all that happened, my wife's alcoholism, and this is her story, had progressed to the point that she ended up going into treatment. And when she went into treatment, it was like shoving a knife in my heart, because all of a sudden, there was stuff going on that I didn't know about. There was drinking at a level I didn't know about. There was money that disappeared that I didn't know about. And suddenly, I no longer had a companion in the drinking in this lifestyle. I now had an enemy in this lifestyle. That's what it seemed to me. We were completely thrust apart. And I would go through probably the greatest hell I've ever been through for any prolonged period of time. Would be for the next 8 years, because for the next 8 years I would try to stop drinking on my own, because I thought alcoholism was all about just stopping drinking. And I would try to be an example of what not drinking looked like. And I didn't realize that alcohol is my solution. Now, I'm the kind of guy that if I don't have some sort of something to just lessen all those feelings, to just quiet that coil spring that's wound up inside of me, to shut that noise off in my head, I can't survive. And that noise was going full volume, and I became the kind of guy that would go out to work, and I would come home 6-7 o'clock at night, and my head would be going, and I'd fall asleep about midnight, and I'd sleep for about 2 hours, and then I'd start wake up and start thinking, that's what that son of a gun said? I know that's what he said. My mind would start going 90 miles an hour. By 4 o'clock in the morning, I'd be back in that service truck, headed back up the road, going to work, and I would just be wide open. I was a guy that started getting involved in other things that my kids were involved in. I mean, we, on one hand, had done a lot of things for our kids during all that time. We had managed to have them involved in a lot of things, and we support them in those things. And I got involved in the local PTO. I was on the chairman of the president of the local PTO at school. I was chairman of the school improvement team. I was on the Gifted Children's Committee. I was chairman of local scout council. I was assistant scout master. I was involved in all these things, but yet when I would come home at night, I later heard from one of my kids telling their story that they would have to hide behind the door when I came in, because they didn't know how Dad was going to come in, and they didn't know whether they'd be able to stay in at night or whether they'd have to go out and hide on the trampoline all night long till the storm blew over. You see, I'm the kind of guy, when I come in like that, your socks might be laying on the floor and I might pick you up and throw you across the room. Or I might just let it go. Nobody knew what to think, and I'm not proud of that. That was absolutely horrendous for me when I heard my son tell that story, because I didn't know that was the kind of guy I was. I didn't know I was pissed off in a spring-loaded position. I didn't know I was the kind of guy living in a level of rage that had become, I had been there for so long at that level, I didn't know that that was the kind of guy I was. I didn't know how quick I would fly off. I didn't know that. So, at any rate, things finally progressed to the point, and it's kind of funny because I look back during that time, and we moved a few years when we were moving some stuff a few years later after all of that. After we all got sober, we found over 100 self-help books that I had written in, drawn lines under, whatever. I had been going to counseling. I'd gone to see a psychiatrist, was seeing a psychologist. I tried all these things, but the last thing that I ever thought I needed to try was AA. Because I didn't know. I just, for me, if I could stop drinking, then that was the end of the problem. And I didn't know that for an alcoholic, that's the beginning of the problem. There are people that can stop drinking and they're just fine, but I'm not just fine when I stop drinking. Everything for me gets worse. I mean, at first it's a little relief, but somewhere along the line I've got to grow, I've got to change, and if I don't change, I'm going to drink again. And so the drinking started again. I couldn't live with the way I was living, and it got worse and worse, and finally, I was confronted, and I went into a local AA meeting. It was on a Friday night, and I walked in, and this little neat little man met me at the door, he and his wife, and he had these pretty blue eyes, and he had on his little blue work coat, and he gave me a big smile and a handshake and offered me a cup of coffee, and I was hooked right there. I didn't get sober right there, but I was hooked right there. There was something about that peace and ease and comfort that man had that brought me back. But with my keen alcoholic mind, I decided that, you know, AA wasn't necessarily going to be the answer, that probably the answer was really Al-Anon, because after all, it was my wife who had the problem. And, if she could just would sober up and quit acting so crazy, then I would be all right. So I went into an Al-Anon meeting, and I remember sitting at that meeting, and all these ladies shared, and then my turn got to share, and I shared, and after I shared, this one lady looked at me, and she said, "I've always heard that when you point your finger at someone else, there are three pointing back at you." I could have slapped the crap out of her. There was something about what she said, though. It was like a moment of truth, but I didn't know it was the truth. You know, you hear something and thing, and it just really strikes you in your heart, but you don't know. And I went that first year, I decided I'd get a sponsor, and I found a really pretty young girl in Al-Anon, thought she ought to be my sponsor. And then finally I found an old lady, because I thought, well, maybe I needed that mother-type comfort, you know, so I got her to see if she'd be my sponsor. And then I found this biker chick who was a double winner, and she said she'd be my sponsor. So, you know, that was kind of the way my first year in AA was, and I was not sober, and I can tell you that. And I would drink again, because I didn't do anything to change, and I was plucked to my old tricks and my own ideas. And I finally, at the end of that first summer, I ended up, that next year, I ended up put the bottle down July the 20th of 98, and I ended up writing an inventory that September, and I wrote it was about 70 pages of just how the world had wronged me. You know, I'm not going to follow directions from anybody. I'm going to do just what I think, you know. About a year later, and I managed to stay sober for a year, or dry for a year. I managed to stay dry for a year. And I got up with a bunch of guys, and I was doing AA, I was doing Al-Anon, I was doing 5 or 6 meetings a week. And I got out to a little weekend getaway with a bunch of guys, and they were all AA guys, and they were talking, and one of them that Sunday morning looked at me and he said, "Billy, I don't know whether you're a real alcoholic or not," said, "you're the only one that can say that, but if you don't get rid of some of that anger, you're going to drink again." And that was the first time anybody ever said anything about anger to me. And and somehow, again, it was like that gal that had the three fingers story, you know. It just, something just clicked inside of me, and it was a moment of truth, and I knew I needed to get busy in AA, and it was suggested to me that maybe I needed to pray for a sponsor. So I started praying for a sponsor, and about 3 weeks later, I was sitting in a little Sunday morning meeting in Madison, and this gal came in the room, and when they asked for a topic for the meeting, she said, "No one greeted me this morning when I came in here, and I think the topic ought to be why nobody greeted me." Well, they all went around the room and deeply apologized this lady for not greeting her. And what I didn't understand was that she had about 25 years or 20 years at that point, and she came once a year to pick up her chip. And she felt like she had deserved a little more respect than she was given. And so this all went around the room. Everybody apologized about not greeting her. And this kid came in the room a few minutes late. He'd heard enough to kind of get the gist of the meeting. And he was sitting down there in the back. I say a kid, he was a little guy. He was actually a jockey, and he was a horse steeplechase horse trainer. And he was new to the area. And so to the very end, they asked if he wanted to share. And he says, "Well, I'm new to the area. Apologize for being late. But pardon me, I would suggest to this lady here," he said, "I've always been taught in AA, if you see a need, you fill it. And I would suggest that had you been the greeter and you had shaked everybody's hand, you would have been able to shake everybody's hand in the room." And you should have heard the gasp that went through that room. I mean, all the oxygen sucked out of the room when that happened. And he had something I wanted. I followed him out the door like a little dog. "Will you be my sponsor? You know. And so we got inside, he says, "Yeah." He said, "Where's the next meeting?" And I said, "Tomorrow night in Orange." And he said, "All right, well, meet me an hour early and bring your big book." And I got over there with him, and just something had broken inside of me. I think there's a moment of grace in all of us when something breaks inside, and we suddenly start to become a little bit teachable, a little chink in the armor opens up a little bit, and we start to hear something that we haven't heard before. Maybe we've heard it, but we just start to hear it for the first time. And I got in there, and we sat down in the front seat of his pickup truck, And we started going through the book, and we went through the doctor's opinion, and we went through the book just like we take anybody else through the book. And I'll never forget one of those nights when we were sitting there, and we went through that third step prayer. And we went through that third step, you know, right after, on page 60, right after how it works, it says, now we're at step three. And for the next three pages, it kind of describes what step three looks like for a guy like me. And she started talking about what a manipulator I was, how I was the actor trying to arrange the show, the lights, the play, the ballet, how I could be nice and I could be thoughtful and kind, or I could be mean, I could be egotistical. And it just blew me away because it was a perfect picture of the kind of character that I was. And maybe I didn't fully understand at that time the impact of which I've always tried to live my life, self-will run riot, and how much I'm trying to control the world around me to suit me. But for a moment, I had a glimpse of that night, and it absolutely changed me, and that propelled me to write my first four-step inventory. That was the first honest inventory that I had written, and it was the best that I could do. And I never forget that experience that I had and going through that with that man, going through that inventory and having that experience, that awakening that came to me after going through that. And I remember that night when I read that fifth step with him, you know, there were a couple of things that came out of that. The first thing that came out was, I'm not so different from anybody else, because he was so kind. And he told me some stories. I started to share some of the things I'd done, and tentatively I shared the worst and the worst. And the more I told, the more he told about himself, and just made me feel not so alone or so different. And I began to realize I'd done some of the same crazy, stupid, foolish things that he'd done them to. And it just really changed me. And the other thing that he changed, that changed in me, is that after hearing me talk, he said, I've heard you talk a lot about your wife tonight. And he says, and I don't know, I can't say it. I suspect she's a real alcoholic. But he said, I know she needs to find a God of her own understanding, and you're not it. And that was a real turning moment for me, that I had to realize that I had to let other people live and have their own experience and go through their own things in AA and make their own mistakes and let the things happen to them that needed to happen so that they could learn and they could see. My wife and I would end up, I would get sober and be sober for 2 years, and my wife and I separated because she couldn't get sober, and the kids said they couldn't stand having their drunk mom come pick them up anymore. And I had to let that girl go, and I'd been with her from since she was 17 years old and I was 22. And I had to let her walk out of that house not knowing what was going to happen to her. But we knew that was the right thing to do. We wanted to have a sober household. The kids were all into Alateen at that time, and they were in a program of recovery of their own, and that's what we decided to do. 1 month after they left, I got tangled up in a forklift. After she left, they got tangled up in a forklift in my shop, and I crushed my right leg, and that's another whole story. That's a whole God story of all its own, how I was able to get out underneath an 8,000-pound lift that was in gear. The things that happened to me that day that enabled me to get out of there and get out from underneath of that thing was just nothing short of a miracle. And I wanted desperately for my wife to come back and be there at the house, but we knew it was the wrong thing to do. And so for the next 6 months, my kids took care of me rather than me taking care of them. I'd have to go through surgery. It would take 30 days for me to go through the surgery. I was on my back for 40 days. The ladies in AA and Al-Anon crowded around, and neighbors crowded around that house, and they brought meals. We had, for 60 days, we didn't prepare a meal in that house. It was food brought to us, 3 meals a day. And we live out in the country, and somebody actually brought a freezer, a brand new freezer, and stuck it in our house so we would have room to keep all the food that was given to us. It was an amazing experience. It was the start of AA on a level that I'd never seen before. People came by and picked me up at night when I could start being mobile and take me to meetings. They started bringing meetings to the house. And eventually I was able to get involved and get active back in Alcoholics Anonymous again. And so I don't forget to tell the story. 18 months later, my wife and I got back together. We have a terrific life today. She is an amazing woman, an amazing example of AA. She sponsors a pile of women. She's super active in AA. She just went back to school and got her RN and her BSN by the age of 60, you know, and working a full-time job and taking care of this knothead who seems not to be able to stay out of a hospital. And she's just a marvelous example of the miracles in Alcoholics Anonymous. My kids and I... 3-4 years, my wife and I were still separated at that time. We had two in college, We had three in college at one point. And we had two in college, and somebody hadn't filled out something, and they lost their funding. They were getting a little bit of support. Both of those kids were working other jobs, and I was paying my part, what I could pay. And I took it on the own without talking to my sponsor. Another mistake. And I decided I would go down to Richmond and get this matter straight, and I would go to the head of the stream for fresh water, and I was going to the president, the dean of the university. So I went down there and got to the dean's office, and thank God the secretary at the dean's office headed me off and put me in touch with the dean of finance. And I went over and saw this lady and told her my tale of woe, and she told me what had happened, and she said funding's already been committed, but let me see what we can do. And a couple hours later, she gave me a call, and she said, my son had offered to take me to lunch. He said, come on, Dad, let me take you to lunch at the place that he worked. And she called and she said, can you meet us halfway? I said, absolutely. So that was the deal. So we kept him in college. And while I was staying there, I was just kind of emotional. I started breaking down, kind of crying. My son, because we had talked about it, he was so happy about us being in recovery. And I said, I guess your old dad's still just not real good about some things, son. I get upset about a lot of things. And he said, Dad, last night, Becky, our daughter, had gone over to his room. They had a bunch of friends over. And he said, we talked about our childhood, we talked about growing up, and we talked about all the things we went through. And we decided last night if we had to do all over again, we wouldn't change a thing. And I just, you know, what can I say? I mean, that's that forgiveness, that's that blessing, that such a, you know, at such a level that, you know, they were able to know that the best had been, we had tried to do our best despite the fact that we were maybe not doing what looked like the best other parents could do, but they knew our heart was in the right place. And anyway, our kids have gone on and done well. Three of them became Eagle Scouts. Our daughter married an Eagle Scout. She actually married a guy that she met in Alateen. So that's kind of a world. I won't go into that. Anyway, we've got a great relationship, and we've got our seventh grandchild is on the way due this coming weekend. So that's we're excited about all of that. And the younger two have gone on and gotten master's and PhDs in engineering. And, you know, all my kids worked for me in the welding business 1 year. And every one of them, somebody asked me, said, aren't your kids, you know, every kids who ever worked for you, ever want to go in the welding business, you know, after all, you've done this? And I said, yeah, they all worked for me 1 year. And I said, every one of them went and got a college education after that. And I said, but what they didn't realize is they worked with me during my driest time. And I was just, I was not a good employer. You know, I was not, I wasn't the loving, kind employer that I could have been and nurturing. And so I was very demanding and controlling and wanted everything just so. I'm a perfectionist. And so, I don't know, it all worked out the way it's supposed to. So they've all done pretty well. There's so many things to say, because you can't stay sober this long and not go through an awful lot of things in sobriety. And like I said, I've been out of the hospital 27 times, but I've gotten through a lot of things. I've gotten a chance to go through liver disease and have full-blown cirrhosis, and it seems like my liver is healing from that after getting healed from the virus. And there are a lot of people didn't make it. And I know a lot of people didn't make it through that virus. It killed a lot of people. And I'm very grateful for the fact that for whatever reason God let me live through it, that there's something I'm supposed to do. I don't believe these things come lightly. And I believe that every day is a grace, day of grace that we're here in Alcoholics Anonymous. There's a little story. It's kind of a classic story that I tell. It's about, you know, sponsorship. You know, Johnny Harris used to say, sponsorship is monkey see, monkey do. And, you know, and that's basically been the relationship that I've had with my sponsor. You know, he suggested it to me, I need to do it. You know, he does it, I need to do it. And some years ago, it was after my wife and I had gotten back together and things were going well. He had a lot going on. He and his wife had separated. He was having his business was being sued for seven figures. He had lost his home while he had a home under construction, and the contractor gone off and smoked it all up, the only thing that he did different was that he got very active in AA again. He'd been active in AA, but he stepped it up to a whole new level, and he started making meetings every day, and he started going into treatment and H&I commitments and going into jails. He had gotten me wired into doing that. And during that time, I was on a job. I had a job that I started for a guy, and it was a big log cabin up on the Potomac River. It was in a multi-million-dollar neighborhood, and I was doing all this heavy, massive welding up there on that thing. And I'm a one-man shop, by the way. But at any rate, I'm up there doing all this work that needed to be done, and it was 0 degrees, and it was I was going up there at like 4 in the morning. I was leaving and going up, and I was coming home 7, 8, 9, 10 o'clock at night. I was going again the next day, and I did that for about 3.5 days. 3.5 weeks, I mean, got that part of the job done, and they were supposed to give me a check, and to make the story short, the check didn't come, and I had really given my heart and soul this thing, put some materials in it, and I had about $10,000 in this job, and I was upset, to say the least. The guy ended up playing a little shell game with me about paying, and it got worse and worse, and I thought I ought to sue this guy. I started thinking about all the things rights I had him on. I started thinking about how I was going to get the attorney, we're going to say this, and then I started waking up in the night, and I was thinking about it all night long, and I would think about what he was going to say, and then what I was going to say, and what the attorney was going to say, and what the judge was going to say, and what person was going to say, and it just went on and on and on, and all the subs were suing these people, and it was just a mess, And at my sponsor, I had to look back and thought about what he had done. And I realized, on page in the back of 552, I believe it is, Freedom from Bondage. And it talks about praying for these people. It talks about praying for those that you have resentment against, praying for those that you would want from them the same peace and happiness that you would want for yourself. And I'm the kind of guy that's thinking of Uzis, machine guns. I'm thinking about setting the house on fire. I'm thinking about doing some really awful things to these people, if you can imagine. I have an active imagination, and that hatred just had grown so much, and I had to start doing it. I had to start praying, and I started praying. And it took several months for me to get to the point that I could see one of their trucks on the road, and I wouldn't just come apart. And at the end of about a year, I could drive down the road, and their car would go by, and it was just like it'd go on by, and it was like there would probably be a blip on the radar. And I wanted for them goodness. I wanted for them to have good things happen in their life. I wanted for them to be successful in their business. I wanted for everything that I could ask myself to be for them. And somehow we'd gotten through that winter. That was a tough winter. That was a big hit. That was a couple of months' income for me and the business. And it was just, we'd managed to get through it, and it was all okay. And about 2 years later, and I need to finish up, so about 2 years later, I came home one night. I'd been away on a little healing venture on this liver disease that I had, and I'd gotten home, and I'd gone to home group, and come home. I guess I got home on a Sunday, went to a home group. Monday night, went to a meeting. Tuesday night, was getting ready to go to another meeting, and walked out the door, and a truck pulled in the driveway, and we're out there in the country, and I couldn't see what it was. But this guy got out the truck in the dark, and he spoke to me, and he says, "Billy, do you remember me? This is Benny." And Benny was the foreman on that job that I'd been on this 2 years earlier. And he said, "I got a check for you in full for how much money we owe you." And of course, first thing out of my mouth is it good? But he said, "Yeah, I reckon it's good." He said, you were the only one out of all the people that didn't go against us. And because of that, we've been saving our money, and we've been working along, and we've got some money for you. We're going to pay you back first." And so they paid me what they owed me. And turned out they had been stuck by the people that owned that property, and they were stuck for about $250,000. Wow. And they ended up, they ended up paying me. And I told my sponsor, when he gets to be as spiritual as I am, those types of things would happen to him too. But No, it's just, you know, it's an amazing thing, the life we live here by following spiritual principles. And I don't know what's going to be right, what's going to be wrong, what's going to happen, that's not going to happen, what's going to be the right thing to do. But I want to finish with this one little story. It's a Buddhist story. It's about an old man. This story can start and stop anywhere. It's a story about an old man, and he's out there in his house, and he doesn't own this house. It's a house that he's allowed to live in for the privilege of working for the owner. And he has one possession, and that's a horse. And he's got this one horse sitting out there, and one night the horse wanders, gets through the gate and wanders off. And all the locals come up to him and said, "Oh my goodness, the horse has wandered off. This has got to be horrible." Said, "How are you going to do without it?" He says, "I don't know if it's a good thing or if it's a bad thing." So about a week later, this horse comes back, and he brings back about 10 wild horses with him. And they get them all in the corral, and they said, "Oh, man, this is wonderful. Look at these horses that your horse has brought back. What a blessing this is. This is just amazing." He says, "I don't know if it is or it isn't." So he has his son comes home with him and decides to go ahead and try to help him break the horses. So his son's out there trying to ride a horse and ends up falling and breaking his leg. Of course, they'd all been pleased that the son had come home, and then now the son's got the broken leg, and they're going, "Oh, what a tragedy, what a horrible thing. Your son has broken his leg. How are you going to manage to train these horses?" He said, "I don't know if it's a good thing or if it isn't." So then all of a sudden, a bunch of troops come riding by, a bunch of the military coming by. They got enemies crossing the border, and they need every able body to go down and fight the enemies. And the son can't go because he's got a broken leg. And so all the neighbor goes, "Oh, isn't this horrible? Because your son could honor you so well by being there, by being representative of your family, by being in the battle." And he says, "Well, I don't know if it's good or if it isn't." So he goes down. They go down to fight the battle, and they all get wiped out. So anyway, that's the end of that story. But the fact of the matter is, I don't really know what's good or what isn't in AA, what things are going to happen to me that are supposed to happen and not happen. My spiritual advisor says that whatever happened to me this past year was supposed to, and that I will learn and grow from that, and something I will gain from that. And that's the way it's been for me in AA. Everything that I think has been bad has been good, and everything I think is good has been bad. Anyway, that's all I got. Thanks for letting me share.
Thank you, Billy. We're going to pass the seven tradition baskets. If you didn't get something out of that, you didn't bring nothing to put it in. Seven tradition states that every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. While contributions cover each group's rent and other expenses, the seventh tradition is essential at every level of AA service. It is both a privilege and a responsibility for groups and members to ensure that not only their group, but also their intergroup, central office, local services, district, area, and general service office remain self-supporting. This keeps AA free of outside influences that might divert us from our primary purpose to help the alcoholic who still suffers. Although the amount of our contribution is secondary to the spiritual connection that unites all groups around the world, we may want to remember that a dollar does not support as many services as it used to. Simple Actions is a home group. If you are interested in joining our home group, please see one of our home group members. Home group members, please identify yourself. Newcomers, you are the reason we are here. Is there anybody in the room tonight in their first 30 days of sobriety? We'd just like to get your first name and welcome you, please. Parker, welcome. Anybody? Hi, Debbie. Welcome. Feels like there's like two more. Hey, Ben, welcome. Tammy, welcome. Did she say Debbie or Tammy?
Sammy.
I'm beef. Anybody else? There's literature available on this table over here. If you can fold it, it is free. Sponsorship in AA is yours for the asking. We urge you, do not delay. If you have questions or would like additional information about sponsorship, I'll be right here after this meeting. Come talk to me. Please feel free to ask questions. Smokers, please use the butt can provided outside and stay well away from the church doors. All meeting audio recordings and upcoming events are posted on our website, simpleactions.net. Could we thank Billy one more time, please? Thank all of you for a wonderful evening tonight. Come back next week for step one. This is from page 164. Our book is meant to be suggestive only. We realize we know only a little. God will constantly disclose more to you and to us. Ask him in your morning meditation what you can do each day for the man who is still sick. The answers will come if your own house is in order. But obviously you cannot transmit something you haven't got. See to it that your relationship with him is right, and great events will come to pass for you and countless others. This is the great fact for us. Abandon yourself to God as you understand God. Admit your faults to him and to your fellows. Clear away the wreckage of your past. Give freely of what you find and join us. We shall be with you in the fellowship of the Spirit, and you will surely meet some of us as you trudge the road of happy destiny. May God bless you and keep you until then. We're going to need some help putting this room back the way it was, the way we found it tonight. All these tables are going to come up. The chairs are going to be linked up into two sections in the middle here, seven rows of seven. Where's Brad? Brad. And where's Chris? Chris. Those two guys know exactly what it's supposed to look like. So we'll appreciate your help after we help us clean it up. And shall we circle up and pray?
Always room for one more. Isn't that right? Well, there's room for two.
He told me the same as well.
Is this all?
Our Father.
Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, the power, and the glory, forever and ever.